So let's come back to our motivation. And a couple of weeks ago, I talked about the requesting prayer before we have teachings, and how important it is to request the teachings and to really feel that we're offering the entire universe. And especially everything that's beautiful in it, everything that we crave and that we're attached to, that we imagine offering all of that to the Buddha when we request to have Dharma teachings. And this thinking like this tries to get it into our head that the Dharma is more precious than all the things that we usually hold on to. So that's a quite important understanding to have in order for a Dharma practice to be successful. Because basically whatever we think is important is the direction our mind goes in. So when we think relationships are important, our mind goes to that. When we think money is important, our mind goes to that. When we think status is important, you know, we put our energy there. And so, since we have so much habituation with other priorities and putting our energy in other places, it's really important before we hear teachings to recall the importance of the Dharma and to mentally give up all those other things that we are so attached to. By doing the mandala offering them all to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And that creates the space in our mind to see the importance of the teachings. Yeah. And so that's one of the branches of the seven limb prayer. And another one is to ask the Buddha to please remain in cyclic existence, to please continue to make manifestations so that we can come across an enlightened being and hear the teachings and get good guidance. And so that too is very important to really request from the depths of our hearts, again, seeing that having that enlightened guidance is so essential for actualizing what's really in our hearts. Okay, so making those two requests, to receive teachings and for the Buddha to continue to manifest, it involves really humbling ourselves and getting rid of the arrogant mind that says, I know it all, I don't need any help, I can figure it out by myself. Instead of really cultivating a feeling of connection and gratitude and respect, which are attitudes that are really important for us to have when we practice. Okay, so with that kind of understanding of the value of the Dharma, then let's listen to the teachings this evening for the benefit of all beings, even the ones we don't like, even the ones we're afraid of, especially for the ones we don't like, and especially for the ones we're afraid of. Self-centered thought and also self-grasping ignorance and how they fit together. One person sent in a little story. He called it the further adventures from the land of I, me, and mine. Okay? So, the first way he tells the story is just according to the conventional I, you know, just kind of what is, or if you're talking in NVC language, according to just stating the observable facts. Okay? Okay. So he says, on Tuesday, while driving the Toyota Corolla home from buying groceries, a decision arose based on the position of the gas gauge to purchase gasoline. A memory arose that the nearby Arco station offered gas at 20 to 40 cents less than other nearby gas stations in exchange for cash transactions. The decision arose to purchase gasoline there. Notice he isn't using I, me, my, and mine. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Upon arrival, there was at least one car in every pump lane, so a decision arose to make a loop around the back of the station and approach from the other side. Upon arriving at an open gas pump, a driver who had already purchased gasoline was trying to exit approached from the other side. He appeared to be angry. That's an emotive word, so maybe we'd say he appeared with big eyes and his complexion was red and maybe a few veins were bulging, okay? That somebody, you know, because he perceived that somebody was blocking what he thought was his lane. Backing up to let the driver through allowed him to proceed and added about 15 seconds to the task of pulling to the forward pump to purchase gasoline. Okay? So that's the empty kind of account without the self. Yeah. Then here's the account with the grasping at the truly existent I. On Tuesday, I was driving my car home from buying groceries, and I decided to get gas. I like to get it at Arco because it saves me money. When I got there, a lot of cars were in my way, so I drove around the back to approach from the other side. Just when I was pulling up to my pump, this guy who had already purchased gas came into my lane from the other side, acting irate that I was blocking him when I had every right to be there. Being an aspiring bodhisattva, I backed up to let him through and dedicated the merit of my good deed to the great enlightenment.
Wonderful.
Okay. Then his meditative realization from this. Arco is able to charge less for gasoline because they have an extra row of gas pumps on their real estate. This boosts volume per square foot versus other stations. The downside is that when it's busy, it's more difficult to negotiate getting in and out because there's no through lane in front of the store where drivers expect one to be. It is good to be mindful of this and extra courteous to other sentient beings who may be experiencing frustration while purchasing gas there. If frustration arises, it may be worth weighing the gas savings against the possible creation of negative karma. Okay? So that's good, isn't it? You know? You can really see where you know, when there's a lot of me, I, my, and mine, and where there's a lot of self-grasping, and how he wrote the first part, you know, without using the word I or my at all. Yeah? Okay. How did you do with that exercise? No? Did you even remember it?
Yeah. I think a few of us did for a few days. We all tried to do our motivations in the morning without the
I, me,
and
mine.
Oh. That was kind of...
No. Yeah.
No. We saw this attempt to do that.
Bagged it.
It was like trying to practice NVC. You know, it takes so much longer.
Yeah, to say things. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But sometimes, I mean, it is really helpful. You know, I mean, saying I sometimes, I think, is just very, very convenient. You know, I did that instead of putting everything in the passive. But to leave out the my, and the me, you know, especially referring to things. Did you do my chores? Yeah. Did you do your chores? Yeah. And, you know, take the possession out of a lot of these things. Okay. Then, regarding the question that arose last week, you know, you had said that when we realize emptiness, then compassion naturally arises, and you had read it in a book, so I asked him to get the quotation, so he got it. Because I remember hearing His Holiness say very distinctly that bodhicitta needs to be cultivated on its own. It doesn't just arise naturally. Mm-hmm. Yeah, even from realizing emptiness. Because if it did, if realizing emptiness naturally gave rise to bodhicitta, then why are there all these teachings on how to generate bodhicitta? Mm-hmm. The Buddha wouldn't have needed to teach that because bodhicitta would have come naturally just from realizing emptiness. But he actually gave extensive teachings on how to develop bodhicitta because it is something that needs to be cultivated, okay, on its own. Having said that, His Holiness here in the portion was reading from the essay on bodhicitta by Nagarjuna, and this essay is a commentary on the Gaudiya Tantra. One verse, it starts out on the Gaudiya Tantra. Okay, so his audience, who's Nagarjuna's audience? Is it baby beginners?
No.
Okay, so it's going to be people who practice the highest yoga tantra, who have heard the teachings on the stages of the path repeatedly, who have experienced the teachings on the stages of the path, who have some bodhicitta, you know, and if they have bodhicitta, it means they have compassion, they have love, and all those things, okay? So here, His Holiness says, Nagarjuna begins with an immediate explanation of emptiness and how to develop the correct view of ultimate reality. First, one studies teachings on emptiness and develops a deep understanding. Through analytical reflection upon this understanding, one reaches a deep ascertainment of the meaning of emptiness. Internalizing this in meditation, the practitioner eventually arrives at a point where there is a distinct experiential flavor. With that kind of personal knowledge of emptiness, it becomes clear that it really is possible to end suffering. Hmm. Okay, so here he's talking about a sharp faculty disciple who, you know, really wants to know that it's possible to end suffering. You know, that that's like the burning thing before they really go into developing all the other stages of the path. Okay. You know that suffering arises from ignorance, a distorted mental state, and you know that there is a powerful antidote to that mental state. There is a wisdom that directly negates the content of that deluded perspective of that ignorant mind. By seeing that you really can negate the root of suffering, you recognize that it is truly possible to end suffering. Okay? Knowing that it is actually possible to end suffering can lead to a powerful feeling of compassion for all beings. Okay, now why? Why? First of all, realize having some understanding of emptiness lets you know that it's possible to eliminate suffering. Why?
Because you realize it's not truly existent, the suffering itself, and that that's not the real nature of anybody's mind or experience.
You can change from where you are to not suffering. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of implicit in that. You realize everything can change.
You see that, you've generated the wisdom that gets rid of the ignorance.
That's it. Yeah. Because when you have that wisdom realizing emptiness, you have the direct antidote to the ignorance. Mm-hmm. So then you know that the ignorance can be eliminated. And then you know that suffering can be eliminated. Okay, that's why the understanding of emptiness helps you know that, that a liberation is possible. Okay, now, why would knowing that liberation is possible lead you to have a feeling of compassion for all beings?
It's from what Kai says, because you see that suffering is useless.
Right.
Before that time, we'd be resigned to this is the way it is, so why would you put any energy in it? You have to have some reason to go forward with anything you're going to endeavor. If you're doomed to failure, why try? But if you see a way, then you would make effort.
Yeah. So you see that the suffering of sentient beings is completely unnecessary, that it exists only because the cause exists, and you now know that the cause can be eliminated, so you have a lot of optimism and hope, which gives you the energy to go forward, okay? So you're able to have compassion for beings who are suffering unnecessarily just because they're under the influence of ignorance. Okay, so you can see the connection there. So then His Holiness says, continues, therefore, after explaining emptiness in his essay on bodhicitta, Nagarjuna says, in the person in whom the realization of emptiness has arisen, there is no doubt that attachment for all beings will arise. Here the word attachment is, the Tibetan word is zhenpa, which sometimes means to grasp, you know, and here they use these words. Some words have both meanings, grasp in a negative way or attachment, seeing sentient beings as really, you're holding on to sentient beings because you have so much compassion for them. Okay? So Nagarjuna says, in the person in whom the realization of emptiness has arisen, there is no doubt that attachment or compassion for all beings will arise. Do you think that that happens for everybody who has the realization of emptiness?
No.
Why not?
Because they haven't been cultivating bodhicitta all along.
Yeah, because they haven't put their mind already in the direction of compassion and bodhicitta from before they started meditating on emptiness. So they have that realization, but their mind doesn't immediately go to compassion for other beings. Okay? Because if it did, then the hearers and solitary realizers, when they realized emptiness, would all have great compassion, and then very easily they would cultivate bodhicitta. But that's not what happens. Okay? So when Nagarjuna says, the person in whom the realization of emptiness has arisen, there is no doubt that compassion or attachment for all beings will arise, he's not speaking about everybody. He's speaking about those who have trained their mind beforehand and put a lot of seeds of the Mahayana in their mind, you know, and have made prayers to be on the bodhisattva path. So that then when they have this understanding, their mind goes to compassion and goes into the bodhisattva path. You know, because otherwise it's not going to do that. Otherwise you realize emptiness and you say, good, you know, I'm a stream enterer now. I just have to become a once-returner, a non-returner, and then I'm an arhat. And so long, everybody, you know. And that's good. I mean, it's nice that people can become arhats. But you can tell that what you familiarize your mind with, even before you have realizations, you know, it makes a big difference. Yeah? It's kind of like, you know, I've spoken before how I've heard about people from other religions doing Zen meditation. And according to your philosophical background, you might do Zen meditation and come up with a totally different result because of what you thought before you did that meditation. In other words, what your philosophical angle is going to influence what you experience in the meditation. Okay? So that's why we spend a lot of time really trying to get our philosophical angle straight and getting our motivations straight, because otherwise we could have different experiences that lead us to generate wrong conclusions from those experiences. Okay? Yeah. And so, I mean, for example, somebody has a fantastic meditation session and it seems they're meditating on Chenrezig, and it Chenrezig just so seems so real before them. And then they come out of that saying, wow, I just had a vision of Chenrezig, and oh, it's like His Holiness tells the story of one Westerner who came to see him and said, I dreamt about 1,000 Buddhas, so I think I'm on the path of seeing, because this is one of the signs of the path of seeing. And His Holiness had to say, well, yeah, but that's not what actually happened when you had this dream. You didn't actualize the path of seeing. So, you know, same here, that if you don't have, you know, you could have this fantastic meditation and say, well, Chenrezig appeared directly to me, you know, I must be on the completion stage of Tantra, yeah, or something like that. And so if you don't understand the path, and if you haven't cultivated a certain framework and certain motivation beforehand, you could have experiences and generate really wrong views or wrong conclusions from them. Yeah.
Does it mean that what you saw is totally wrong? No.
I mean, that person, you know, they had a very clear meditation of Chenrezig. That's fantastic.
Okay.
But it doesn't mean that they're on the completion stage.
Mean they have the realization.
Right.
The vision is, it could be really Chenrezig.
It could be, or it could be your mind. It doesn't really matter. Because anyway, it's not Chenrezig's not completely outside and not completely inside either, is it? Yeah. So the thing is, you have experiences, then you say, oh, that's nice, what can I learn from them? But you always come back to, therefore I have to keep practicing. Yeah. It's when you draw conclusions from your experiences that are incorrect, and then you can go down really a wrong path. Yeah, like somebody could do Zen meditation. I mean, I think I told you before about one rabbi who did Zen meditation, and no, he was a Buddhist. He was a Jubu, and he was a Buddhist at the time, and did Zen meditation, came to the conclusion that God exists, and went and became a rabbi. You know? Well, that's the wrong conclusion from doing Buddhist meditation, because he didn't have, what was he familiar with? His upbringing. You know, and how do you describe certain things? Okay? So when His Holiness mentioned this same thing again, you know, he said, as we have seen, Nagarjuna teaches that attachment to other living beings will rise spontaneously in the person who realizes emptiness. When he says, as we have seen, he's referring back to that first explanation. Okay? So he's not making this general statement about realizing emptiness will immediately give you compassion. Okay? Good. Anything more on that?
Yeah, it's like what Arya Deva said in one of the earlier verses that I found really helpful. When he was talking about basically the bottom line was, you have to have the world view before you study emptiness.
Yeah. 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 You have to have a worldview, and you have to have it was this whole thing of, why do you learn about conventional truths before learning about emptiness, if the realization of emptiness or suchness is what actually liberates you? Then why do you learn all the rest of the stuff? You know, because if you don't, and especially if you don't have a strong foundation in karma and its effects, if you meditate on emptiness and have some experience of a void of some sort, whether it's genuine emptiness or not, you jump to the conclusion that nothing exists, which is the wrong conclusion. Yeah. Whereas if you have a lot of training in dependent arising and in cause and effect, and you understand, oh, you know, effects arise from causes, they don't just come out of nowhere, yeah, and that things are posited dependent on each other in mutual relationship. They don't exist on their own, you know, and that things are imputed by term and concept. Even if you haven't realized the deepest meaning of that, still you've put that in your mind. You know, oh, things are dependent. There's causal dependence. There's mutual dependence. There's dependent designation. Yeah, things are dependent on their parts. So then, if you have some feeling of, you know, emptiness, again, whether it's an actual realization or not, afterwards you remember, oh, you know, things exist dependently. And that pops into your mind right away. Oh, yes, when I examine them with ultimate analysis, I can't find them. But when I don't examine them, they exist and they function dependently. And so you have lots of imprint in your mind about that. Yeah. So then that really helps when you, you know, begin to meditate on emptiness and you know, have some kind of experience. Yeah. Okay.
So I'm curious about this, the way if there's a different, depending on one's conceptual framework, you going into a meditation, the experience can be different. And there's one notion that I don't remember you clearly talking about during the Minds and Awareness teachings, but I've heard before, read somewhere, that if you meditate on something, even if it's non-existent, then you can have direct perception of it. Is that correct? First of all.
No.
No.
You can't directly perceive something that doesn't exist.
Right. Okay.
Can you?
I wouldn't think so.
No.
Doesn't seem to make sense.
No. You know, maybe you can have a mental image of something that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Rabbit's
horn. Yeah. Yeah. Or maybe, I mean, you can cultivate things in meditation that become objects of mental consciousness, even though they don't exist.
Yeah.
Okay. But that's different, you know, I think, than what you're saying. For example, if you do the meditation on the body and on bones and everything being bones, and so, you know, how you remember when we did, and then the whole universe is just full of bones. If you can develop samadhi upon which you see all those bones with your mental consciousness and samadhi, and those bones are an object of mental consciousness. Okay, but there's no bones. You're not perceiving real bones. Okay, and there you've cultivated that for a specific reason, to help you overcome your attachment to the body. Okay, so it's not called a wrong consciousness, because you know that the universe isn't just full of bones.
But then, so a mental direct cognizer is always going to be generated independence upon first having really gotten a clear conceptual appearance.
Oh, there's all sorts of mental direct cognizers.
Oh, right. I guess
there's
all
sorts of
yogic.
Them. Okay. A yogic, you know, direct perceiver, yeah, you have to have, you know, you go from wrong conception to doubt, to correct assumption, to inference, and then to direct yoga perception.
So I'm just trying to like really clarify and get rid of the kind of view that's like, you know, it's not really understanding why people can't, you know, have a valid meditation experience
without knowing anything. Yes, because we would really like that. You know, there's something in us. We want to have, you know, a direct, valid, fantastic meditation experience without knowing anything.
Why not?
Or okay. Hold that
yeah, why not? You know, why can't it just come? Now, His Holiness does talk about there's some people who in previous lives, you know, have meditated very deeply and have generated all sorts of, you know, strong imprints and really strong realizations, so that in this life, when they sit down, these understandings come fairly quickly to them. Okay. Now, without a lot of study in whatsoever this life, but they did it all last life. So we would like to think, well, maybe I'm that kind of person. Yeah? When I study this life, I can't understand anything, but maybe in the past I have all sorts of seeds from understanding it in past life, and they'll just ripen and I'll have a realization. No, if you don't understand it this life, it's not that you understood it last life. If you understood it last life, then when you start to study it this life, the understanding is going to come back to you, you know, and you'll get what you're hearing. But if you're not getting what you're hearing and reading, you know, then don't think, oh, I'm sure those seeds are buried there somewhere, you know. Let's just, you know, get them to come out somehow, because I really want to have a valid meditative experience. I really don't want to go through this three countless great eons bit, you know. I mean, I don't want to even go through 3 decades in this life. 3 days maybe I can manage.
So part of purification is to be able to do it in this life, to be able to remove the obstacles, the cloudiness, the inability to maybe, if not in this life, to create the causes, to have some clarity sometime.
Yeah. I mean, in this life, even you're listening to teachings, you know, even you don't understand, I've said this many times, you think you don't understand, but something is going in, you know? Because even in this life, you can see the difference in having listened to the same teaching, which at the beginning you were going, huh? Now, you've heard it a few times, something's more familiar. You can understand it a little bit better. Yeah? So actually, we're coming up to a verse that says this. Okay? Yeah? But I think, you know how at the beginning I said that this feeling of humility is very important on the path? It is. Yeah, it's really important to be humble. Humble does not mean lacking self-confidence. You need very strong self-confidence to practice the path. But you need to be humble. Because if you have these kind of egotistical things of, you know, I'm going to sit down, I don't know anything, but wow, I'm going to have, you know, direct perception of emptiness, then, you know, and you really think that, that's a little bit arrogant, don't you think?
It'll become an obstacle.
Yeah, it becomes a huge obstacle. Yeah. I mean, I remember my first meditation course, you know, Lama Zopa gave some teachings on emptiness, and the old students were going, wow, he's never taught this before, this is fantastic. And I came home and I listened to the tapes, and I really studied and everything like that. And Lama and Rinpoche used to do these things of Sangha exams at the time, where a Sangha member had to get up and give a talk on a topic, and then everybody would ask questions. So I thought, I wasn't even ordained at that time, I thought, well, sometime I'm going to do a Sangha exam and talk about emptiness. You know, I mean, just a little bit arrogant after one Dharma course.
Look now. Carried you a long way.
Well, it took Song Rinpoche saying to me, you're not going to understand the answer. Yeah. So, you know, it's important to not be puffed up, because it does become a very, very big obstacle. Yeah. And equally, it's important to not, you know, denigrate yourself and have low self-confidence, because that also will become an obstacle. Okay. We're coming to this. Let's go on. Okay. Oh, here it is, the first verse. Verse 197. Okay, so this is about through familiarization in this way, nirvana will definitely be attained. Okay, so Aryadeva says, through knowing reality, even if now one does not attain nirvana, one will certainly gain it effortlessly in a later life, as it is with actions or karma. Okay, so even if we don't attain nirvana in this life, okay, by knowing something about the reality of dependent arising, that's free from the extremes. What are the two extremes?
Nihilism
and absolutism. Okay, what's absolutism? What are you doing there?
Grasping
things as truly existent. So you're superimposing a mode of existence on things that they don't have. Mm-hmm. Okay. In the extreme of nihilism, what's going on there? Yeah, you negate too much. There you're deprecating. It's also called the extreme of deprecation, where you're deprecating and, you know, you're cutting off too much there. Okay, so even if you don't gain the realization of emptiness that's free from the two extremes in this life, he's saying, we'll certainly attain it in a future life by continuing to practice. And the example is, he says, as it is with actions or with karma, that you can create the cause now and experience the result in a future life. So we're creating the cause now by studying and, you know, contemplating all these things, yeah, putting the causal energy in there. Then in a future life, it will ripen. Okay? So the point is that it's very useful and very important to familiarize ourselves with suchness and to try and understand it. You know, and even if we can't have some experience of it, at least, you know, to understand it a little bit, and at least in your mind to kind of play with the thing of, you know, oh, yeah, everything looks so real, but there's actually just the parts there. Or everything looks so solid, but it only exists because its causes exist. Yeah. Or everything looks like it's out there, but actually, it depends on the mind looking and, you know, picking out details and conceiving and labeling it. You know, so just kind of calling that to mind periodically in your life puts in very good imprints in your mind. You know, it's what Aryadeva was saying in a verse before about it starts to tear samsara asunder. Okay, so we should, you know, really know that, and if it doesn't come about this life, then, you know, future lives, I put all that energy in. You too.
She says, "I'll just sit here all the next time."
Yeah. Well, she's hearing a lot of teachings. You know, they'll help her in her future life. Okay. So then, Joe Blow has a reappearance, and he comes back and says, if many people have understood suchness, why don't we see people who are released from samsara? Okay? This is John's question. Yeah. If many people have realized suchness, so why don't we see them here, you know? And, yeah, I mean, it doesn't sound too hard. You just realize that, you know, all this inherent existence isn't there. That doesn't sound too hard. So how come we don't see all these realized beings, you know? And I want to be one of them. Okay? So Aryadeva says, accomplishment of all intended actions is extremely uncommon. It is not that nirvana is absent here, but conjunction and the released are rare. Okay, so he's saying accomplishment of all intended actions is extremely uncommon. In other words, that just because we intend for something to happen, Yeah, it doesn't mean, and you know, that it's going to happen. And even if we create the, you know, some of the actions, some of the causes for it to happen, it doesn't mean that all the conditions are going to come together immediately for it to happen. Okay, I mean, we can see that. Last autumn we planted the bulbs for the tulips. Okay, did they grow over the winter?
No.
Okay, will they grow in the spring? Hopefully. Yeah, so you put the causes, they don't necessarily ripen right away. You have to wait for the conditions to come about. Okay, so he says it's not common that through mere intention we create the actions that result as we intended. Sometimes we have the intention, oh, I want to attain enlightenment, but we don't know how to create the causes. Or we don't create the complete causes. Or we don't even have the external conditions, you know, to begin to create the causes. Yeah, you may have a lot of spiritual yearning. If you're born in a place where there's no teachers, no teachings, no texts, yeah, you have a spiritual intention, but you don't have the external conditions to make it happen. Okay? So so it's not that no one aspires for liberation, but it's rather that the causes and conditions seldom come together so that the released, in other words, the people who are released from samsara, those who are liberated, are actually rare. Yeah, because we need the external conditions, such as a spiritual friend, yeah, and a human body, and the time and leisure to be able to study and practice and to have our human intelligence and be able to do that. So we need external conditions, we need internal conditions, and those don't all come together. Yeah. And he's also saying another internal condition is the correct mental approach. Okay. In other words, we have to have faith in the teachings. We have to see the teachings as valuable. No? And a lot of people, you know, zero faith. They think Dharma's just a bunch of baloney. Yeah? I mean, that's kind of the way their mind thinks. So it's actually very difficult to have all the conditions come together. So, you know, that's in response to Joe Blow's question about why we don't see all these liberated beings running around. Okay, Gyaltsev J says in his commentary, childish people think they are inferior and lack the patience to apply themselves to the path, so they don't attain liberation, they aren't released. Childish people think they are inferior and lack the patience to apply themselves to the path. Does that sound like anybody you know? Okay. So what's the relationship between seeing yourself as inferior and not having the patience and the fortitude to apply yourself to the path? How does, you know, seeing yourself as inferior make you lack that kind of patience and fortitude?
Because you don't think you'll ever achieve the goal, so why apply?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you think you won't ever attain anything. Yeah. I'm incapable, path's too hard, the goal's too high. Yeah. So why try? Because if I try, oh, it's just so much effort.
Too hard.
Yeah. So much effort, too hard. And I don't want to go through that hardship. I want the quick, cheap, and easy road. Yeah? Okay. So, but it's interesting that when you have a poor self-image, it leads you to have no fortitude, no ability to go through even a teeny amount of hardship or difficulty. Yeah? So it leads, it's the mind that is saying, I just want to be comfortable. I don't want to go through hardness and difficulty. And I deserve to be be comfortable because I'm inferior. Now that's a good syllogism. I deserve to be comfortable because I'm inferior. That's what we're saying to ourselves, isn't it? Now, okay, check that out. Yeah? I am inferior. Is that true?
No.
If you're inferior, do you necessarily deserve to be comfortable?
No.
Why do those two things have anything to do with each other? Nothing. Yet this is the kind of logic we use to tell ourselves why we don't have to put forth any effort. You know, because I'm hopeless, God, Buddha, somebody, the universe, should have pity on me and give me my realizations without me having to try. You know, this is what our mind is thinking, isn't it? We have all sorts of silly junk in there. Yeah? And so we sabotage ourselves. We sabotage ourselves. Okay, next verse. So, Job Lowe, again, the same question. This has come up in this chapter many times. How do we know for sure that afflictions can be eliminated? You know? Because this is tying into the poor self-confident, poor self-image, you know? Oh, I don't even know if it's possible to eliminate the afflictions. And mine are, you know, inherently existent and they're a permanent part of me. So I don't really know if liberation's possible. So why should I make the effort? I just deserve to be comfortable. How we think. Yeah? Okay. So, Aryadeva says, on hearing the body lacks good qualities, attachment does not last long. Will not all afflictions end by means of this very path? Okay, so on hearing the body lacks good qualities, attachment does not last long. Why? Upon hearing the body lacks good qualities, attachment for the body doesn't last long.
That's the whole okay. thing about the mindfulness of the body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What's this lack of good qualities of the body?
Nature of it.
It's permanent. We think it's beautiful. We think it's permanent. We think it's the source of happiness.
Yeah.
Source of enjoyment.
Yes, we think it's the source of enjoyment. We think it's pure. We think it's permanent. Yeah. We think it's me. It has a self. Okay. So when you hear that the body lacks good qualities, what is that? What does that mean?
That would be the first step on hearing, thinking, and meditating, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. It's your first starting to hear, think, and meditate. And so what direction is your mind going into? What are you beginning to think about? Yeah, but aren't you thinking about impermanence?
Oh, right.
Yeah. Yeah. The foul nature of the body. That the body's in the nature of dukkha, that the body lacks a self. Okay. So when you're doing that kind of meditation on the body, your attachment for the body isn't going to last long. Mm-hmm. Okay? Because what you're thinking is the exact opposite. How you're seeing the body is the exact opposite of how attachment sees the body. So the attachment can't stay in place. Because the attachment seeing the body is beautiful, source of pleasure, and now your wisdom is seeing the body as sinews and joints and a liver and blood and guts. Yeah. And that the and that you're not going to get any lasting pleasure from the body. Okay? So, will not all afflictions end by this very path? Okay? So, if we meditate on dependent arising, free from the two extremes, okay, it will be possible to eliminate the afflictions, because when we meditate with dependent arising, okay, then we're going to see that things can, you know, it's being inherently existent is impossible, because if things are dependent, they can't be independent. And independent existence and inherent existence are synonymous. Okay? So again, if you meditate on dependent arising, you're going to see the opposite, or you're going to understand the opposite of what ignorance is grasping at. Okay? So that ignorance will not last long. And so since that ignorance can be eliminated, then liberation can be attained. Have you seen how often that question has come up in this chapter? There are a few questions that come up again and again. I mean, in all the chapters, Joe Blow keeps coming at the same thing from different angles, because he really doesn't want to give up his wrong conceptions, you know? It's the yes but mind. Yeah, that's who Joe Blow is. He's yes but. Okay. Then verse 200 is about showing by analogy that though birth connecting us to the next existence is beginningless, it does have an end. So Joe Blow says, how can the beginningless continuity of rebirth come to an end? Good question, isn't it? Begins something without beginning, how can it have an end? Aryadeva says, just as the end of a seed is seen, though the seed has no beginning, when the causes are incomplete, birth too will not occur. Okay. So if we look at a seed has no beginning. Yeah. Because the seed came from the plant, it was made up of all these other substances that came from other substances that came, I mean, there's a whole physical, a whole history of material causes, you know, of the elements that have come into making the present seed right now. So you trace it back, maybe if you're a scientist, you trace it back to the Big Bang, okay? You say that was the beginning. Actually, how can the Big Bang be the beginning of all material existence, of all mass? Yeah. I mean, because they're thinking when there's the Big Bang that things are so, everything's so concentrated that then it bang and you know, you have everything. So even if you're positing the Big Bang, you know, you're still saying that there's a previous continuity of everything. And so even before the Big Bang, there's a physical continuity of all these different things. Okay? They may change forms, and the, you know, atoms and molecules may do different things, but there's some kind of dependent arising continuity that we can trace back beginninglessly. Okay? Yet, the seed, the energy of the seed to produce a sprout can be cut off, can't it? Yeah. I mean, the material things from the seed will go on and they'll be recycled. But, you know, the ability of the seed to produce a sprout will stop. So in a similar way, you know, our mind stream is beginningless. There's always a previous cause, a previous moment of mind. The mind stream is endless, you know, it'll go on. But the attachment, the clinging, the ignorance that causes the rebirth can be cut off. Okay? So it's kind of like, you know, the seed, the material stuff of the seed goes on, but the seed's ability to produce a plant gets cut. So here, too, the continuity of the mind goes on, but the ability of ignorance and craving to produce another life gets cut. Okay? So, although the continuity of a seed has no beginning, it can end by being burnt. Okay? Similarly, the causes for samsaric rebirth are made incomplete by eliminating self-grasping. Through the strength of the antidote, rebirth and samsara due to afflictions and polluted karma will not occur again. Once an oil lamp's fuel is finished, it will not burn. Okay? So once the ignorance is cut, then the craving and all the afflictions are cut, then the creation of new karma to be born in samsara is cut. But you might still have in your mind stream karmic seeds from before to be born in samsara. So what about those?
Pure.
Well, for the Buddha, yeah, all those seeds are purified. But for an arhat,
no conditions.
Okay, because the arhat hasn't eliminated all the cognitive obscurations. Those seeds are still there, but they can't ripen into a rebirth because the cooperative condition of clinging and grasping, craving and clinging don't arise. So those seeds can't ripen.
So what happens to those seeds?
They sit there, or sometimes they'll ripen in a way where an arhat can have an experience that other people, that is unfortunate, even though the arhat wouldn't necessarily experience pain because of it. Okay? So maybe an arhat has some really strong negative karma from a previous life, yeah, that can't ripen as a new rebirth, but maybe it'll ripen in him or her having a severe illness and dying young, even though they're an arhat.
They wouldn't have mental pain about it, but they might have physical pain, right?
Well,
they don't have the merit to get rid of it.
Yeah, they may have some physical pain, but it's not a whole lot, and they certainly wouldn't have the mental pain. Okay, we have finished the 200 verses. There's still a couple of concluding verses, but I think we better wait for next time for those. We have time maybe for one or two questions people have.
Based on the exercise you had us do, I was thinking more and more about is it possible that self-centered thought is an acquired affliction then?
Is it the self-centered thought an acquired affliction? Acquired means you learned it through philosophy. Acquired means that when you were a baby you didn't have it. Did you have self-centered thought when you were a baby?
Well, I was just imagining if parents taught your child not to use those pronouns.
What?
If a child was taught not to use I, me, and mine.
Oh, if a child didn't learn the language of I, me, and mine, do you think they would still have self-centeredness?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. Babies don't know how to talk. Are babies self-centered? Yeah.
Extremely.
Yeah.
I was also thinking another way. I assume that it can have a positive impact if you don't give the kid so much impression that this person is an individual. You put it more in a group, for example, like in Eastern countries and Asia, some countries where they have more group feeling. That could be helpful.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely the way you're brought up will influence how strong your self-centeredness is and how it manifests. Yeah. Because you're right, if you're brought up in a culture that teaches you to be an individual, then it's, that self-centeredness is going to be quite strong. And also if your family thinks a certain thing is important, or your teachers think a certain thing is important, then chances are your self-centeredness may come out in relation to that particular thing. You know, if your family encourages you in athletics, or encourages you in studies, or encourages you to be a bully, or, you know, whatever it is, then that can influence where your self-centeredness, you know, kind of goes to easily.
But also, if your parents don't treat the kid very well, your self-centeredness will arise too, because you learn to defend yourself or to protect your being. So the opposite can happen, even if you don't get this kind of coach support.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. If you don't get much attention from your parents, also you become self-centered. So look at it, you know? Until we get rid of our own self-centeredness, it's going to keep popping up, no matter what our parents do. So, sorry folks, we can't blame our parents for this one. You know?
In fact, anything they do to curtail our... I mean, that's what manners are, right?
Yes. If anything, what our parents are doing are curtailing our self-centeredness. You know, I mean, they teach us to be courteous, they teach us to refrain from always pushing to get our way. They teach us to share. Yeah. I mean, our parents have to do a lot of conditioning just to get us to, you know, be nice people, or to even have the semblance of being a nice person. Yeah. So I remember when I was little, I always thought, you know, oh, I don't like being disciplined. I didn't do anything wrong. And if I did, it was always my brother's fault anyway. And I got blamed because I was the oldest. But, you know, that was just self-centered thought, isn't it? You know? And parents all the time trying to, you know, get you to learn to get along with other people. Yeah, share your things. No, you can't have this right away. You have to wait. Oh, that was so hard, wasn't it? Yeah, I want this right now. Yeah. And our parents had to teach us to wait. Yeah? Or they had to teach us how to create the causes for what we wanted. So now we still cry, I want this right now. So...
just do it a lot quieter.
Yeah, we're a lot more circumspect about how we do it. But we still do it, don't we? Yeah.
I have one more question. The teachings say also when you purify, you have to see it in the light of dependent arising. Could you explain that, how to...
Okay, so when they say when you do purification practice, like you're doing now during the retreat, then it's good to meditate on dependent arising, because that's very strong purification. And I think one way to do it is to look and see the agent, action, and object of the negative karma, that those three are all dependent on each other. Yeah, that they, you know, there's not like an inherently existent me who was there, and then this concrete object came along, and then we did this, you know, self-existent action, and created some concrete negative karma that can never ever be changed because it's inherently existent. Yeah. But to really see, you know, there's all these things that are flowing together and multiple causes, multiple conditions.
Because I was buying it again and again, and my mind is always kind of hooking in and wanting not to take it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very difficult.
Yeah, the mind is resistant because it's resistant even to what's going to make us happy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. no, this is an inherently existent negative action. I can never grow beyond it. My whole life is stained and ruined because of this experience or because of this action that I did. Yeah? What kind of baloney is that? You know, and yet a lot of people, yeah, have some experience or do some kind of action. That's the self-image they create of themselves.
He said, who does? Because I have difficulty with that. When we have done the action, the seed is there. It will ripen.
Yeah.
But you're telling me I can change it by purification.
Yeah.
That's why I have difficulty. It won't ripen anyway.
No. If you plant a seed in that garden, is it definitely going to grow into a plant?
No.
Why not?
Well, maybe she's already dead, or lack of water, lack of light, lack of whatever.
Right. The seed becoming a plant, you know, and a certain, you know, a plant of this size and this, you know, and everything, that it has the potential, but it isn't something inherently existent that just by the seed alone, that plant is going to come. Yeah. If you don't water it, if it gets insufficient sunshine, if you burn it, yeah, if you pull it out and you drench it in water and it becomes rotten, you know, that seed is not definitely going to produce a result. Yeah. It's like when you're cooking, you put stuff in the pot, yeah. Does that mean it's going to burn? Because you put it in the hot pan. Does that mean the food's going to burn? No, there's a lot of things you can do to keep the food from burning. It's not a given that it's going to burn. Okay? So we planted seeds, but, you know, if you do a negative action, it's certainly not going to ripen in happiness. But exactly how and to what strength a given seed will ripen in either happiness or suffering depends on so many other conditions. So I think part of, you know, when as you're learning the Dharma, you begin to see the power of the conditions, that the cause is powerful, but the conditions are powerful. And if you're lacking just one condition, the whole thing can't happen. Yeah. And that there's so many conditions that need to come together for something to happen, but if even one of them is lacking, the whole result is going to be totally different. Or may not even have it at all. So we learn a little bit how to work with karma. So we know, okay, I have negative karma on my mind stream. Well, we also know if I put myself in a situation where there's a lot of people with attachment to sense pleasure, or a lot of people fighting or quarreling, or, you know, this kind of environment, I know that I will so easily have those thoughts generated. And I know that when I have those kind of thoughts, then it's very easy for my negative karma to ripen. And I'll experience suffering. Yeah? It's like, you know, oh, if I drink and if I dope, it's very easier, or take whatever drugs or pills it is, it's very easy for my negative karma to ripen in my getting in a car accident. Yeah? So you know that. So you don't take the drugs and the alcohol, and you don't drive when, you know, you're not clear-minded, because you know that that kind of condition is a setup for the ripening of negative karma.
Mm-hmm. And I think we're strong to education when the negative karma ripens, your mind is just calm.
It's just what?
Calm.
Calm, yeah.
I was just thinking about Geshe Kabul from Speed Evil, you know, with the whole pancreatic cancer. Like,
yeah.
I've had a good life. It's okay. I mean, the pain must be unbelievable.
Yeah.
It's so...
Yeah. Yeah. So, yes, and how the karma ripens, how you experience it. When we were in the year before last, in December of 12, you know, when we were at His Holiness's teachings in Ganden, there was one Geshe La from Thabo, which is in Spiti, and he came to the house where we were staying, and he has pancreatic cancer, and he's dying from it. You know, there's really nothing they can do. And he's completely, you know, matter of fact, his attendant was so much more bummed out than he was. His attendant was really worried and kind of full of distress. And Geshe La was like, he said, you know, I've had a good life and I really rejoice in it and I know I'm going to have to die sometime and, you know, I'll live well as long as I have to live. And he was fine, you know, with the whole thing. So.
That's practice.
Yeah.
That's the fruit of incredible practice.
Yeah, that is the fruit of incredible practice. Let's dedicate.
There are spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lobsang's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the 3 worlds always increase. Guru Ratna Mandala Kamiryatayami.
Due to this merit,
may we soon attain the awakened state of Bodhisattva, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy, mountain, pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends.
May the deeds of
explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and non-violent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West Glory.